Welcome to Hour 1 of the Arizona Republic for Friday, January 17th, 2024. I'm your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Joe Napoli. As usual for Friday, we have quite a lot of political news. Most of it in this edition is state and local. But we do start with a story about President Biden's farewell address. And the lead story features a photo of him sitting behind a desk giving that address. The article is titled, Biden, Thank You for This Great Honor. Outgoing President Highlights Successes, Warns of Future Dangers, by Michael Collins. President Joe Biden bid goodbye to the American people on Wednesday night, saying in a farewell address that serving as president has been the highest honor of my life, but warning that dangers on the horizon pose a serious threat to democracy. The America of our dreams is always closer than we think, Biden said from the Oval Office. It's up to us to make our dreams come true. Biden's nationally televised remarks come just days before he leaves office and President-elect Donald Trump returns to the White House. Trump, who defeated Biden's Vice President Kamala Harris in November, will be sworn in for a second term Monday. Biden's 13-minute address served not only as his departing words after 4 years in the nation's highest office, but also as a coda to a career of public service that spanned more than half a century, celebrating a ceasefire deal. Much of Biden's time in the Oval Office has been consumed by events in the international stage, with wars raging in Ukraine and the Gaza Strip. Just hours before he addressed the nation, Biden announced a possible ceasefire and hostage release deal after more than 15 months of war between Israel and the Palestinian militant group Hamas. The Biden administration brokered the deal along with Qatar and Egypt. Biden started his speech by reflecting for a few minutes on that agreement, which he said had resulted from 8 months of nonstop negotiations. Biden also noted that under his watch, Ukraine is still free nearly 3 years after it was invaded by Russia. NATO has been strengthened, he said, and we pulled ahead of our competition with China. Touting job creation, the president also used his address to tout what he sees as his accomplishments on the domestic front. When he came into office 4 years ago, the nation was still reeling from the deadly COVID-19 pandemic that had wreaked havoc on the economy. The pandemic wiped out 22 million jobs because businesses were forced to shut down temporarily. But through resilience, he said, the country bounced back, creating 17 million new jobs in the process, with entrepreneurs and companies setting up new businesses and industries hiring American workers using American products. He pointed to his administration's campaign to modernize the nation's roads, bridges, and tunnels, bring high-speed internet to rural Americans, and invest billions of dollars to bring semiconductor supply chains back to the United States, where they belong. He also cited efforts giving Medicare the power to negotiate lower prescription drug prices for millions of seniors, and the passage of the most significant gun safety law in 3 decades. Oligarchy threatens democracy. While he celebrated the past, Biden also warned of dangers in the future, particularly the potential rise of a tech industrial complex and an oligarchy of extreme wealth and power that he said threatens American democracy. Americans are being buried under an avalanche of misinformation and disinformation, he said, enabling the abuse of power. The free press is crumbling, he said, while social media is giving up on fact-checking. Artificial intelligence is the most consequential technology of our time, he said, but could spawn new threats to individual rights and privacy unless safeguards are put in place. Biden also warned of a dangerous concentration of power in the hands of a few ultra-wealthy people who he said must be forced to pay their fair share of taxes and play by the same rules as everyone else. Ending presidential immunity. He never mentioned Trump by name, but Biden called for the passage of a constitutional amendment to make sure no president is immune from crimes he or she commits while in office. In July, the Supreme Court ruled presidents cannot be prosecuted for official acts during their time in office. The court's ruling stemmed from the Justice Department's case against Trump over his efforts to overturn the 2020 election. Trump became the first former president to hold a criminal record after he was convicted in New York last year of 34 felonies involving hush money payments to an adult film actor. He was also indicted on multiple felony charges related to his handling classified documents after he left office and his efforts to overturn the 2020 election leading up to an attack on the Capitol by a mob of his supporters on January 6, 2021. But 3 weeks after Trump's victory in November, a judge acting on the request of special counsel Jack Smith, who deferred to Justice Department policy not to prosecute a sitting president, dismissed the charges that Trump tried to steal the election in 2020. Smith also effectively ended the classified documents case by dropping his appeal of a separate judge's dismissal of those charges. May you all be keepers of the flame. During almost every speech he has given during the past 4 years, Biden has ended with soaring language intended to lift up Americans and inspire them to reach for the sky. We are the United States of America. There is nothing, nothing, nothing beyond our capacity when we do it together, he often said. He chose different words for his sign-off on Wednesday, but the sentiment was the same. Biden said after 20 years of public service, he still believes in the ideals for which the nation stands, that the strength of its institutions and the character of its people matter and must endure. Now it's your turn to stand guard, he said. May you all be keepers of the flame. I love America. You love it too. Thank you for this great honor. We turn to a local story titled, Phoenix Could Close Hiking Trails for Months. Plan proposes shutting down May through October, by Caitlin McLeod. Popular Phoenix hiking trails were closed for 45 heat warning days last summer, but the city could go further. Under a change proposed for next summer, those trails would have shut down for nearly 4 months from May to October. Such closures, a cumulative 116 days from May to October if the policy were in effect in summer 2024, would have affected some 1,600 hikers per day on average on three mountainous parts of the city heat safety program, an Arizona Republic data analysis found. The Phoenix Parks and Recreation Board recently added South Mountain to the closure list for next summer, joining Camelback and Piastowa Peak. The board is now considering whether to block hikers on days where the temperature is forecast to exceed 105 degrees, which Phoenix routinely exceeds for much of the summer. Trails have previously closed from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. when the National Weather Service declares heat warning days, meaning there is a high risk for heat-related illnesses. The board recently opted to close trails earlier, starting at 8 a.m. next summer, and members are considering bumping that even further back to 7 a.m. Board members will hold a work study session on potential hiking restrictions on January 23rd and again during February. The board is scheduled to meet at 5 p.m. in Phoenix City Council chambers and encourages people to participate in person or via WebEx. Far fewer people hiked Piastowa during heat warnings this summer compared with 2020, and on South Mountain, where it appears hikers self-regulated. It's not clear if the board has a target number of hikers. Board Chair Kelly Dalton declined requests for an interview. In October, board members reviewed data showing a drop in the number of mountain rescues where trails were closed, but an increase in other areas where rescue calls shifted to earlier times as hikers tried to avoid the hottest parts of the day, according to meeting minutes. Dalton brought up the 10-year-old boy who died on South Mountain this summer, noting the preserve was not included in the city's heat safety restrictions. Hikers have pushed back. They are just taking away freedoms from the people, said John Bowden, 54, who trail runs year-round on South Mountain. We live in the desert. You can either sit in your house and become a mushroom, or something, or go out and embrace it. The city started closing Camelback and Piastowa trails on the valley's hottest days after a fire captain nearly died from overexertion, and several others went to the hospital following 3 mountain rescues on one day in 2020. How many people hike Phoenix Mountains on the hottest days? At least 690 people on average hiked Camelback and Piastowa combined on heat warning days in 2024, likely squeezing in early morning or evening summer hikes. Blocking Piastowa may have deterred hundreds of hikers, as about 56% fewer people tackled the Piastowa Summit Trail during this summer's heat warnings compared with 2020, according to the Republic's analysis. The effect on Camelback is less clear, as one of its 2 trails was closed for 2.5 years, and traffic from the closed trail may have diverted to the open one. About 100 people hiked the Echo Canyon Trail per day during heat warnings in 2020. The number tripled in 2021 and has since mostly trended downward. While South Mountain trails remained open year-round, hikers there appeared to heed heat warnings. About 790 people hiked the mountain on heat warning days in 2024, compared with about 1,600 in 2020. The number of South Mountain hikers is certainly much higher, as the sprawling preserve has numerous unmarked and unmonitored neighborhood entry points. Phoenix has installed infrared trail counters that record the daily number of people at established trailheads across the city. What prompted Phoenix to close hiking trails in the summer? In 2020, a Phoenix fire captain, a fitness enthusiast who completed an Ironman triathlon, hit his limit after 3 mountain rescues on a hot summer day. He developed rhabdomyolysis, a condition where muscles break down from overexertion and flood the kidneys with toxins. Rhabdo, as it's more commonly known, can be lethal. The captain and several other firefighters with him were taken by ambulance to the hospital. He went into renal failure, remained hospitalized for weeks, and quit mountain rescues, said Phoenix Fire Department spokesman Robert McDade. That was our come to Jesus moment. We had an Ironman athlete almost die, McDade said. We looked at that and said, we don't want to have another day like this. Department officials assessed the incident. Was their training insufficient? Could they have deployed crews differently? Were the firefighters unprepared? No, officials determined. The firefighters and paramedics who chose to do mountain rescues trained for 6 weeks before they tackle their first and continue training once a week. They hydrate before, during, and after their shifts. They stay in peak physical shape. They dress light on mountain rescues, cotton shorts, hiking boots, breathable white long-sleeve shirts that reflect the sun, bucket hats, and lightweight helmets with a headlamp. But they carry loads of gear. On the mountains, they become ambulances on foot. Defibrillators, IV bags, heart monitors, bandages, cardiac and pain medicine. They have ropes if they need to climb the side of a rock wall to save someone, and a stretcher on a large wheel for hikers who can't walk down the trail but don't need a helicopter. That's all distributed among the first 4 crew members who respond. They're followed by others who bring double and triple more, plus hooks and a seat if they need to link an injured person to a helicopter, McDade said. They must be ready for anything. During one particular rescue, a firefighter donned a bee suit, rappelled from a helicopter, swung into an active nest, and grabbed a hiker who had ventured off trail. We have firefighters who grew up loving the outdoors, mountain climbing, rappelling, whitewater rafting, a love of adventure, a love of high risk, McDade said. These folks hang out on the side of helicopters, and they can't believe they get paid for it. On the day the captain who got rhabdo almost died, the team hadn't done anything out of bounds for their job. 3 rescues and 1 triple-digit blazing hot day was just too much. Firefighters just don't tap out, McDade said. So we looked at why we are doing so many of these. That prompted the Parks and Recreation Board to consider closing trails. That summer, the city mountains were packed. Likely folks stir-crazy from the isolation of the COVID-19 pandemic. On average, nearly 6,200 people hike per day during heat warnings. Mountain rescues during heat warnings have declined from 57 in 2021 to 35 this summer. Who gets rescued most on Phoenix hiking trails? When seasoned hikers see news about rescues on a city mountain, some speculate on social media whether the person was unprepared and whether they were from out of state. In one Facebook group of Arizona hikers, people have commented that the folks getting rescued should have to pay fines or take common sense classes. Most people whom Phoenix firefighters rescue have overextended themselves. McDade said the crew commonly helps people in moderate shape who thought visiting an air-conditioned gym meant they could climb Camelback Mountain. Camelback's Echo Canyon Trail, for example, gains about 1,500 feet in elevation in just over a mile, with the last half mile requiring some fairly dicey rock scrambling for the casual hiker. But it's not true that most people who need to be rescued are visitors. In 2024, firefighters rescued 97 Arizonans from city mountains, about half of them during summer months that were the hottest on record. The next most common states were Texas and Illinois, with just 6 rescues the entire year. Over the past 4 summers, firefighters rescued 200 Arizona residents from city mountains. They rescued 86 people from other states and Canada. What do hikers want to see on Phoenix's mountain trails? Hiking is a hot topic in the valley. More than 350 people have responded to the city survey asking for the public's opinion about managing heat on mountain trails. A group of dedicated hikers has set a proposal of alternatives to trail closures and sought a meeting with parks staff. Bowden, who is part of that group, said hiking in the heat isn't dangerous for people who know what they're doing. He runs about 2 to 4 miles in South Mountain during summer afternoons. He wears light-colored clothing, brings a lot of water, always takes his phone, and wears an ice bandana. Last year, about 250 to 300 trail runners organized to go out between 2 and 5 p.m. and run on a mile loop for 3 hours, he said. It's 112 degrees, and someone might say, "Why would you do such a thing?" It's because we can. We're educated. You're right. It's hardcore, but live life. He describes the city's trail closures as an incredible overreach that negatively affects people who depend on them to squeeze in exercise between work and childcare when the middle of the day may be their only option. "It's an embarrassment as a native Phoenician that we would ever do this," he said. Bowden's group proposed a variety of ideas to the city, including requiring permits for people who hike on high-risk days and a stupid hiker law to hold people accountable for unprepared hiking or risky behavior during heat warnings. The group has also proposed installing hydration stations, shaded rest stops, and emergency phones on popular trails, expanding the fire department's drone program to find distressed hikers more quickly, and stationing another team of mountain rescue-trained firefighters at the base of South Mountain. The city spokesperson responded to Republic questions on the board's behalf, did not say where the city staff had ever considered these options in the past, but one idea would meet clear resistance from first responders, a stupid hiker law. Potential penalties could deter people from dialing 911 when they're in danger, McDade said. "There should never be an environment where you're reluctant to call 911, McDade said. You can reach Caitlin McClade at caitlin.mcglade@arizonarepublic.com. You can now take Sun Sounds with you on our new mobile app available for both Android and iPhone. Next, we turn to an article titled "Lawmakers' Stolen Valor Bill is Personal" by Ray Stern. A Republican state lawmaker who accused a primary election opponent of lying about his military record last year wants to make stolen valor claims a serious felony violation. "The bill's not a personal vendetta," Representative Walt Blackmun of Sholo told reporters at a news conference on Wednesday about his proposed law. But Blackmun later acknowledged to the Arizona Republic his personal connection with the bill. Blackman is a decorated 21-year veteran of the U.S. Army and former tank commander who received the Bronze Star for his service in Iraq. He faced a grueling six-way primary election last year for two open seats in the Arizona House of Representatives. During the race, he called out opponent Steve Slalton, owner of a Donald Trump merchandise store in Sholo, for altering military records to imply he had combat duty. The two candidates already had been sparring publicly. Blackman tried unsuccessfully to obtain a one-year restraining order against Slayton, arguing Slayton intimidated him and his family and lied about him to potential voters. In June, Blackman wrote a letter to state leaders and veterans groups slamming Slayton's military claims and announcing his plans to make such disgraceful acts a felony. "I started out the bill that way, to be honest," he said, when asked if the bill was personal. "However, looking into the background of it, seeing all the cases and seeing the fraud that was out there, it transitioned. I didn't want it to be about him. I wanted it to be about the other veterans out there." Blackman calls his bill the Master Sergeant Orlando Donna Valor Act, paying homage to a veteran combat pilot who served in Korea and Vietnam. Donna's son, retired U.S. Army Master Sergeant Jack Donna, spoke at the news conference on Wednesday about his father, who died in June, and the bill's importance to veterans. "The issue of stolen valor and people claiming military honors they never earned is becoming more and more prolific," Donna said. "This bill is the tool, the wire brush, if you will, that will hopefully take off the tarnish and the stain on our beloved chain of honor." What does the Stolen Valor Bill do? Blackman's bill would make impersonating a veteran in order to gain certain benefits a Class 4 felony. But if the benefits amount to $50,000 or more, the crime would be a Class 2 felony on a par with a manslaughter charge. Anyone convicted of the crime while serving in public office would be forced to step down. The bill lists several benefits that would trigger a charge, including securing votes, campaign contributions, or political advantages, in addition to monetary benefits like compensation for health care. Falsifying military records or wearing military medals, awards, or badges that denote special skills or combat duty not lawfully earned would also be illegal. That part of the state law doesn't mention benefits, but Blackman said the law wouldn't violate someone's First Amendment rights to wear military gear or medals as long as they are not trying to obtain some kind of benefit. "You can walk around with everything you have on," Blackman said. "If you break the law and you steal from the state by claiming you are a veteran, that is not protected under the First Amendment." Congress passed the Stolen Valor Act in 2005, which made a misdemeanor of falsely representing oneself as the recipient of a military medal or reward. The original law had to be changed, however, after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in 2012 it violated the First Amendment and reversed the conviction of a man who lied about his military service. Stolen Valor claims hit two Arizona politicians in 2024. Slayton claimed in campaign material he served as the crew chief and co-pilot in a helicopter gunship in Vietnam, and also said on a radio show he was a combat veteran in Vietnam. He gave a purported copy of his discharge paperwork to a Payson radio station that contained a list of numerous awards that do not appear on the same documents provided by the government. The Mountain Daily Star, an Eastern Arizona news site, conducted an exhaustive examination of records and determined they did not support Slayton's claims. In a June interview with The Republic, Slayton said his official military discharge papers had been altered after he became an identity theft victim and insisted he was a combat veteran. He did not return a phone call on Wednesday. Chandler Vice Mayor O.D. Harris also faced accusations over his military service last year after The Republic reported records don't back up his claim that he served in the U.S. Army for 3 years working in counterintelligence. Harris won another four-year term in November in spite of criticism over the discrepancies. Complaints about stolen valor reached up to the presidential race last year when Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, the Democratic vice presidential candidate, had to confess he misspoke about carrying weapons in war. You can reach the reporter at rstern@arizonarepublic.com or 480-276-3237. Follow him on X at Ray Stern. The Valiant State page starts with an article by Taylor Seeley titled, "Phoenix Vice Mayor Choice Turns Sour. O'Brien is Selected Despite Councilwoman's Rejection." Phoenix City Council selected a new vice mayor for 2025, but what is normally a jovial and celebratory decision turned sour on Wednesday. In a 7-1 vote, the 9-member City Council selected Councilwoman Ann O'Brien to serve as a backup to Mayor Kate Gallego for the next 12 months. The role is largely ceremonial and comes with no extra power, aside from the positive perception that may be associated with the title. The vote turned tense when Councilwoman Betty Guadardo rejected the nomination, saying she didn't believe O'Brien was adequately prepared or fully committed to serving every part of this city. She noted the position is not merely a supporting role, but rather a city-wide leadership position. "It is crucial for us to foster unity as we move forward, and I fear that selecting someone who does not embody these values could hinder our progress," Guardado said. After the meeting, Guardado told the Arizona Republic there were moments where O'Brien's comments lacked the necessity, sensitivity, and understanding of the issues faced by our communities of color. "There have been instances where her comments appeared careless and did not reflect an understanding of the nuanced challenges our diverse communities face. She has shown that she does not recognize the importance of effectively serving our Spanish-speaking community leaders and residents," Guardado said. "These communities deserve thoughtful representation, and I believe she should consider how her words and actions can impact their trust in local leadership," she added. O'Brien, who was first elected in 2020 to represent District 1, Northwest Phoenix, did not visibly respond to Guardado's criticism. Afterward, O'Brien told the Arizona Republic she was thankful to be selected and looked forward to continuing to work with all her council colleagues. She said her future efforts would focus on home affordability, police reform, and eviction prevention. "Over the next year, I will be focusing on efforts to increase housing attainability by reducing barriers to home ownership, cutting red tape on bureaucracy, and reducing the time it takes for the private sector to go from shovels to ground to keys in the door," O'Brien said in a written statement. She added she would work directly with lawmakers to pass the Home Ownership Act to do just that. O'Brien, who released a lengthy homeless solutions plan in 2023, said more than 60% of these proposals are completed or are in the process of being completed. The next step, she said, would be creating a legal clinic where residents can receive assistance and representation in eviction cases. Eviction filings in Phoenix hit a record high in 2024. "I've always said, Republicans don't make sure your potholes are filled, and Democrats don't make sure the grass in your parks is mowed. Your nonpartisan city council and mayor do," O'Brien said. Taylor Seeley covers Phoenix for the Arizona Republic and azcentral.com. Reach her at tseely@arizonarepublic.com or by phone at 480-476-6116. You are listening to Hour 1 of the Arizona Republic for Friday, January 17th, 2025. I'm your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Joe Napoli. You can listen to our programs on demand by going to our website, sunsounds.org, and clicking on the link titled Broadcast Info. Our next article is Arizona Republican Election Bill Trades Convenience for Quicker Results by Mary Jo Bitzel. Republican lawmakers want to speed up ballot counting after another election cycle in which Arizona lagged most of the country in wrapping up its vote count. But that change, outlined in a bill that passed its first hurdle Wednesday, comes with a cost. Voters will have to give up the convenience of dropping off their sealed ballot on Election Day and instead submit it no later than 7 p.m. on the Friday before the election. That is the key change outlined in Senate Bill 1011, which passed the Senate committee on a party-line vote after more than 2 hours of debate. The bill draws heavily from Florida, where Arizona politicians and citizens alike have watched enviously as voting outcomes are regularly known on election night. Bill trades slight inconvenience for quicker results. Senate President Warren Peterson, a Gilbert Republican and the bill's sponsor, said the legislation takes aim at the piles of early ballots that arrive on election day, requiring time and effort to verify the voter's signature on the ballot affidavit. By moving the drop-off deadline back 4 days to 7 p.m. on the Friday before the election, county recorders will have time to process those ballots and have them ready for tabulation as soon as the polls close. As for those piles of ballots that voters now return on election day, there are several options in the proposed legislation, but all of them will require some extra effort from voters. The trade-off of some convenience for faster results is what drove the 4-3 vote by the Senate Judiciary and Elections Committee. Senator John Kavanaugh, Republican of Fountain Hills, said the measure will create a slight inconvenience for voters who used to zipping to a voting center on Election Day, bypassing the line in favor of in-person voters and quickly dropping off their sealed ballot. Instead, those voters will be asked to get in line, show ID, and feed their ballot into a tabulator. Having to wait in line is not suppressing votes, Kavanaugh said. He compared it to having to wait in line at the grocery store or at a doctor's office. He voted for the measure, along with fellow Republican Senators Shauna Bolick, Mark Fincham, and Wendy Rogers. Democrats object, while counties, election officials back change. Democrats said the proposed changes will cause confusion at the polls. This is going to come as a surprise, Senator Annalise Ortiz, Democrat of Phoenix, said of voters. She predicted voters accustomed to showing at the polls on election day to drop off their sealed ballot might not be prepared to stand in line and show ID, especially if time is tight or they didn't think to bring an ID. Similar concerns came from Democratic Senators Lauren Kuby of Tempe and Teresa Hathaway of Tuba City. Pinal County Recorder Dana Lewis agreed it will take a massive voter education outreach, but said her county is up for the challenge. She supports the bill. So does Tom Galvin, chairman of the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors, which has oversight of Election Day procedures. The Arizona Association of Counties also is in support, but cautions the bill is not perfect and could use some tweaks. Maricopa County Recorder Justin Heap, newly elected in November, also backs the bill, but suggested rural counties might be exempted from some of the proposed changes due to a lack of staffing and the funding needed to change the system. For example, the bill calls for counties to provide early voting locations that would be open on Saturday and Monday before an election, which would require more staff time and could strain a county budget. Arizona Secretary of State Adrian Fonte's office estimates the proposal would double the number of voters on Election Day. More funding would be needed to accommodate the increased number of ballot tabulation machines, said George Diaz, a lobbyist for Fonte's office, as well as for voter education. The bill would create more polling locations by mandating that public schools be used as voting sites. A similar measure was discussed Wednesday by a House committee. However, House Concurrent Resolution 2013 from Representative Alexander Kolodnin, Republican of Scottsdale, would put the measure on the 2026 ballot for voters to consider. If approved, it would be added to the Arizona Constitution and can only be changed by another vote of the people. Kolodnin's bill has not yet had a formal hearing. Reach the reporter at maryjo.pitzl@arizonarepublic.com or at 602-228-7566 and follow her on Threads as well as X, the platform formerly known as Twitter, at maryjpitzl. Our next article is linked to a nighttime photo of some police officers in front of some demonstrators. The caption reads, "Demonstrators chant, 'Free those kids,' and hold abolish ICE signs in downtown Phoenix on July 12, 2019, to protest the Trump administration's roundup of undocumented migrants. The article is titled, "Protesters Lose Their Lawsuit Against Phoenix Police Officer" by Miguel Torres. A federal jury rejected a lawsuit against a Phoenix police officer filed by two protesters who claimed their constitutional rights were violated after they openly criticized the police in 2019. The case stemmed from a protest in central Phoenix against Immigration and Customs Enforcement treatment of children and families. Protesters blocked Central Avenue, and Phoenix police dispatched a tactical unit. More than a dozen people were arrested that July night after police ordered the protesters to disperse. Phil Martinez and Jorge Soria were the last to be arrested. They claimed they were singled out for arrest because of their criticism of the police, which they said distinguished them from the other stragglers who remained after the scene was mostly cleared. Martinez and Soria filed a lawsuit against the department, the city, and several officers, claiming they had been targeted for arrest because they were criticizing the police. After months of litigation, the plaintiffs narrowed their focus, dropping the suit against the other named defendants and leaving only one, Benjamin Moore, the lieutenant in charge of the tactical unit at the protest. After a day of deliberation, the jury delivered their verdict Wednesday afternoon in favor of Moore. After the verdict was read, Moore's attorney, John Masterson, said Martinez and Soria were not targeted because of their criticism of the police. "They were people screaming profanities at the police all night, and they weren't arrested," he said. Mart Harris, an attorney from Martinez and Soria, said the case, although unsuccessful, should serve as a warning to Arizona law enforcement about addressing constitutional violations. "Law enforcement should be on notice that we won't stop pursuing these issues. It takes one jury. It wasn't this jury, but it may be the next one," Harris said. "So if these things continue to happen, they'll continue to be brought to court." Although the jury returned its verdict, a sanctions motion over the defense's presentation of evidence was still pending. Lawyers from Martinez and Soria alleged Moore gave false testimony about what audio and video evidence showed, misleading the jury about whether a third person, someone who was not speaking out against the police, was singled out for arrest. A judgment should have been entered against Moore because of it, they have argued. Our next article is titled, "Anti-Hazing Law Will Affect Colleges. Will Be Easier to Track Incidents on Campuses" by Helen Rummel. It will soon be easier for Arizona students and their families to track hazing incidents on college campuses. The Stop Campus Hazing Act was implemented this year after being signed by President Joe Biden in December. It aims to prevent harm after several high-profile hazing incidents in the country, some of which turned deadly. The law will bolster measures shortly after Arizona passed its own anti-hazing law measures in 2022. Arizona colleges receiving money from federal student aid programs will now be required to disclose all incidents of hazing in their annual security reports and identify the groups found in violation of school policy. These changes are coming to Arizona after Governor Doug Ducey signed Jack's Law in 2022, adding criminal penalties against students who haze their peers. The law was enacted after 19-year-old Arizona State University student Jack Cololius died following a fraternity social event in 2012. Students found guilty can be sent to jail for up to 6 months or prison for up to 3.75 years if the hazing results in death. The recent law will require organizations found to be violating the school's hazing policies to be named in a new campus hazing transparency report. Universities are also required to establish research-based prevention programs. The Stop Campus Hazing Act is a major victory for student safety, Executive Director of the Cleary Center, Jessica Mertz, said in a statement. "Every student deserves to feel safe at school, and families have the right to know the scope of hazing on college campuses." Even with new law, not all reporting is available. Each of the schools in Arizona's public university system discloses information about organizations accused of hazing to varying degrees. The University of Arizona and Northern Arizona University both disclose which organizations are under investigation under public databases. ASU does not. The spokesperson with the university said ASU does share information about groups found responsible for hazing. When asked if the university publishes this information online, the spokesperson declined to comment further. A review from the Arizona Republic did not find a recent list of suspensions for ASU readily available on its website. The latest anti-hazing law will not require ASU to disclose pending investigations, only if a group is found responsible. At UA, three fraternities are currently under investigation for allegations of hazing, and three are under sanctions for hazing and other offenses. At NIU, the Delta Chi fraternity is suspended until June 2029 following an investigation into hazing and other offenses. At ASU, Kappa Sigma was suspended in 2020 following a lawsuit filed by a former pledge. The Sigma Phi Epsilon fraternity was closed in 2019 by its national office following an investigation into several hazing incidents. How common is hazing in Arizona? The prevalence of hazing on college campuses can be a tricky thing to pin down, according to experts. Students may be hesitant to report or even be unclear as to what the full definition is. The Arizona Board of Regents defines hazing as any intentional, knowing, or reckless act committed by a student against another student in connection with the initiation or membership of a group. It must create a substantial risk of potential physical injury, mental harm or degradation, or causes physical injury. Some prevention measures already exist in the state. At UA, the school has a hazing prevention coalition where organizations can request presentations for their members or receive support. NAU hosts annual summits for club and Greek life leaders to learn how to prevent hazing. ASU is a member of the Hazing Prevention Consortium, which allows the school to work with experts to prevent hazing. In a 2022 survey, roughly 1.5% of students who responded said they had experienced hazing in the last 3 months. That could still be an undercount, as many experts have said students may choose not to report hazing. Universities across the country may already be meeting some of the newly set standards, says Jeff Weimer, a partner focusing on higher education with the law firm Reed Smith. Weimer said requiring universities to disclose which organizations have a pattern of multiple hazing incidents could go far when students are deciding if a group is right for them. The goal there is to increase transparency and enable students and their families to have better awareness of the potential prior incidents that a particular organization has been involved in, Weimer said. The bill did not have much opposition, Weimer said. Greek organizations like the National Phalanthetic Conference also voiced their support, alongside families of hazing victims and a bipartisan group of legislators. By increasing transparency about hazing incidents, accountability, and risk prevention measures, this law has the power to prevent future acts of hazing on college campuses, a release from the organization read. NPC represents dozens of sororities across the country. Students and parents can report hazing through the Hazing Prevention Network hotline at 888-668-4293. Helen Rummel covers higher education for the Arizona Republic. Reach her at hrummel@accentral.com. Follow her on X, formerly Twitter, at helenrummel. We turn to some less horrible news about the wildfires in Los Angeles with the USA Today article titled, Much Needed Break in Wildfire Weather. Dangerous Conditions Could Return Next Week by Tao Nugent, Christopher Kahn, Trevor Hughes, and John Bacon. Firefighters made progress in their battle against two massive wildfires, but residents must prepare for a return of the strong winds that could rekindle and spread the flames, authorities said Thursday. All particularly dangerous situation red flag warnings largely expired by Wednesday night without any significant fire growth, according to the National Weather Service. Temperatures were expected to drop 5 to 10 degrees below normal for the remainder of the week, with Friday predicted to be the coldest. Good news! We are expecting a much-needed break from the fire weather concerns to close this week, the Weather Service's Los Angeles office said on X. Bad news. Next week is a concern. While confident that we will not see a repeat of last week, dangerous fire weather conditions are expected. Los Angeles Fire Department Chief Kristen Crowley said a large amount of unburned dry fuel combined with low humidity and the expected return of the harsh Santa Ana winds next week could bring more devastation. She urged residents to clear all brush within 200 feet of their homes. Flying embers from a wildfire can destroy homes over a mile away, Crowley said at a briefing Thursday. She asked residents to provide first responders with a fighting chance to save homes if the fire spread. Mudslides are also a concern. Los Angeles County Public Works Director Mark Pastrella said he expects massive debris flows when rains finally arrive. The county is scrambling to prepare flood control systems for the onslaught, he said. The fires have reduced entire neighborhoods along the Pacific coast and inland near the San Gabriel Mountains to ash and rubble. At least 25 people have died, and more than 12,000 homes, businesses, and other structures have been damaged or destroyed. The Palisades and Eaton fires, along with several smaller blazes, have burned nearly 40,000 acres in Los Angeles County, according to CAL FIRE. The Palisades fire was 22% contained Thursday, and the Eaton fire was 55% contained, CAL FIRE said. As many as 200,000 people were forced to flee from their homes. About 82,400 people remained under evacuation orders, and another 90,400 faced evacuation warnings as of Wednesday, Los Angeles County Sheriff Robert Lunis said. The Los Angeles County Health Office issued a new order prohibiting the cleanup or removal of fire debris from damaged and burned properties until a hazardous materials inspection is completed by an approved government agency. California Governor Gavin Newsom issued an executive order Thursday to help with the housing needs of thousands of displaced evacuees. The order directs state agencies to support local governments in developing temporary housing plans and streamlines construction and occupancy of accessory dwelling units, small living spaces that share lots with larger homes. The order makes it easier to place temporary trailers and other housing on property while destroyed or damaged residences are rebuilt, and it extends price gouging bans on hotel, motel, and rental housing in Los Angeles County through March 8th. Newsom has also stepped in to block land speculators from targeting residents who lost their homes and are already being offered buyouts for their prime real estate. In an executive order issued Tuesday, Newsom temporarily banned unsolicited undervalue offers to buy properties in 15 specific fire damage zip codes, including Altadena and Pacific Palisades. Buyers in post-disaster areas have historically argued they provide much-needed cash infusions to people who've lost everything and face years of fighting over insurance if they had any at all. Newsom said in his order he worried that predatory developers would try to buy land from traumatized residents after facing the loss of everything they own. As families mourn, the last thing they need is greedy speculators taking advantage of their pain, Newsom said in a statement. We will not allow greedy developers to rip off these working-class communities at a time when they need more support than ever before. Pacific Palisades resident Beverly Arbach said someone has already tried to buy the land where her house sat, sight unseen, telling her to name the price. She declined, telling the prospective buyer that she and her husband were well insured and planned to rebuild. Before the fire, real estate company Zillow estimated that Arbach's three-bedroom, 1,676-square-foot home is worth around $3.1 million. An empty, slightly smaller lot up for sale before the fire was listed at $3.2 million. Here, what's really valuable is the land, said Arbach of her neighborhood, overlooking Santa Monica Bay. The core of Pacific Palisades was originally developed by the Methodist Church as an affordable retirement area for church employees. once home to carpenters, electricians, and mail carriers, the neighborhood's property values have skyrocketed over the intervening decades, especially as owners renovated the once small houses to add bedrooms and bathrooms. In Altadena, longtime residents also worry that the historically minority community will be priced out during a recovery and rebuilding. Fears of speculators and developers swooping on the tails of a disaster are a long-standing concern, although there is mixed evidence about whether it reflects reality. An August 2024 review by the Texas Real Estate Research Center at Texas A&M found no systematic increase of investor purchases following recent floods there. But a 2023 analysis of hurricane-hit areas in Florida from 2000 to 2016 found neighborhoods damaged by hurricanes saw richer people moving in as damage was restored. Arbeck said she expects extended litigation first, but she's looking forward to living around her neighbors again. "We're going to rebuild. And almost everybody else is saying that," she said. By the way, you can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device. Our next article is titled, "Phoenix Accepting Applications for Permanent Police Chief Role," by Elena Santa Cruz. Phoenix is inching closer to finding a permanent head for its police department. Applications are now being accepted for a new police chief who would oversee a department grappling with how to respond to the U.S. Department of Justice's conclusion that policing in Phoenix has widespread problems, including a culture of training officers that using force is de-escalation. The department has not had a permanent police chief since Jerry Williams retired in the summer of 2022. Interim Police Chief Michael Sullivan was tapped for the position in September 2022, about a year after the Justice Department announced its investigation. In June, the DOJ released its report and said it found that Phoenix police used excessive force, discriminated against people of color, treated people with behavioral health issues improperly, violated the rights of people experiencing homelessness, and restricted the rights of protesters and failed to adjust policing tactics with children. The Phoenix City Council voted to extend Sullivan's contract shortly after the report's release. Sullivan said he intended to apply to be the permanent police chief, according to a KJZZ report. The new chief would oversee a $981 million budget and over 3,800 police officers and professional staff members. Phoenix hired a firm to help with the search. Finalists are expected to be announced in March, and a public forum is expected to be held. The new chief would be announced in April. The deadline to apply for the position is January 27, 2025. Next, we turn to an article titled, "When Will It Rain in Phoenix? Here's What the Experts Say," by Haley Evans. Metro Phoenix is known for its dry heat, but not so much during the winter. However, Phoenix is experiencing one of the longest dry spells on record, according to the National Weather Service. As of Thursday, January 16th, it had been 147 days since it last rained at Phoenix Sky Harbor International Airport, which ties the record set in 2023 for the second longest dry spell. And it doesn't seem likely to rain in the near future, said Catherine Brislevich, a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Phoenix. "Here's what to know about the dry weather Metro Phoenix has seen in the past month, including when the last rain fell, and what to expect in the coming days. When was the last time it rained in Phoenix? August 22nd was the last day Phoenix saw measurable precipitation at Sky Harbor Airport. That means, as of January 16th, it had been 147 days since it rained in Phoenix, which tied 2023 for the longest dry spell on record. The longest stretch without rain recorded in Phoenix was 160 days in 1972. Assuming the streak continues, Phoenix would tie that record on January 29th. Why has it been so warm and dry in Arizona? While parts of Arizona are typically warmer and drier than most of the country, this past fall and the current winter seasons are unusual. Meteorologists attribute the trend to atmospheric conditions preventing wintry weather. While a high-pressure system is the primary culprit for a mild winter so far, La Niña could be playing a role. Meteorologists have issued a La Niña watch due to cooler oceanic temperatures in the Pacific, which tends to produce warmer and drier conditions across the Southwest. Right now, we do have troughs coming through, but we haven't had the moisture, Brislavich said. We finish Hour 1 with an article titled, Diplomats Hope Israel-Hamas Ceasefire Will Hold. Deal features gradual drawdown of IDF forces, by Terry Collins of USA Today. Relieved, hopeful, even optimistic. Those are the immediate reactions of some peace builders in the Gaza Strip, the U.S. and elsewhere Wednesday, after Israel and the militant group Hamas reached a new Gaza ceasefire and hostage release deal. I can't tell you how relieved our staff in the region are, as are our members. This has been the hardest 15 months of any of us have ever endured, said John Lydon, executive director of the Alliance for Middle East Peace, a fast-growing coalition of about 170 organizations worldwide working toward peace-building, especially among the Israelis and Palestinians. As this deal takes root, we must immediately turn our eyes toward what comes next, he said. Scheduled to start Sunday, the truce is intended to stop the fighting that has devastated Gaza, caused unrest in the entire Middle East region, and left tens of thousands of people dead in the process. Mediated by the U.S., Qatar, and Egypt, the deal includes a 6-week initial ceasefire phase and gradual withdrawals of Israeli forces from populated areas of Gaza. It also covers the release of hostages held by Hamas in exchange for hundreds of Palestinian detainees held by Israel. On Thursday, however, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu accused Hamas of backtracking on some details of the Gaza ceasefire deal, holding up its approval by the Israeli government. Hamas reneged on part of the agreement reached with the mediators and Israel in an effort to extort last-minute concessions, a statement from Netanyahu said. The Israeli cabinet will not convene until the mediators notify Israel that Hamas has accepted all elements of the agreement. There are lots of opportunities for breakdown, Lydon said. The deal will take lots of good faith and continued international and local pressure to ensure it's fully implemented, so that we do not return to the daily horror and loss of life we've seen in Gaza, and that every hostage is reunited with their loved ones. Shamil Idris, CEO of Search for Common Ground, a Washington, D.C.-based peacebuilding group, agreed. It opens up an opportunity, a fragile opportunity that hopefully translates into a permanent cessation of violence, Idris said. Ultimately, we hope this begins an inclusive political process, which is the only thing that will bring Israelis and Palestinians lasting security. And that's all we have time for Hour 1 of the Arizona Republic for Friday, January 17th, 2025. I'm your volunteer broadcaster, Joe Napoli, thanking you for listening to Hour 1 and encouraging you to stay tuned for Hour 2 and our other great programs here on Sun Sounds of Arizona.